The committee would come to order, please. This is the Senate State Affairs meeting. It is Tuesday, February 15th, 3:35 in the afternoon. Members who are present at this time, Senator Wagner, myself, Senator Terrio, Senator Huggins, and Senator Eltham. We have four bills on the schedule today. My intent, we might get to final action on Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 2. It's a fairly easy subject. An overview on the Executive Order 113. And really, no committee action is required there. If we wanted to take action to overturn the executive order, it would take a separate Senate concurrent resolution to do that. And then we've got Senate Bill 72, Oath of Notaries, Public State Seal, and hopefully we'll get to the overview on that bill. We want to start off, however, with Senate Bill 88, Policy on General Fund Revenue Shortfall, and we have Senator Gary Wilkin here to give us an overview of this legislation. And staff is handing out a fiscal note that just came in on that bill. So. Senator Wilkin, go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Senator Terrio, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 88 this afternoon. I'd like to take about perhaps a half hour in a presentation of about 20 slides that looks back in a little history, financial history, and then looks forward. Many of us in the room talk continually about a long-term fiscal plan. Last year we spent a lot of time on a percent of market value and worked that over. In the course of that, I think it fostered a lot of discussion in different people's minds about how we move forward, because at the outset, there's no question in my mind, and I think most of ours, that we have a structural deficit in our general fund spending in this state. We're in the gravy years today, but that is going to change, and it will change to the hundreds of millions. So this is a suggestion on how to fund those revenue shortfalls and the effects of it. So with that, I'd like to start building a bridge to development. This law states that it puts in the Executive Budget Act a statement, the policy of the state of Alaska, that the amounts necessary to cover projected shortfall in general fund revenue during a fiscal year be appropriated equally from the Constitutional Budget Reserve, the CBR, and the Earnings Reserve, the ERA. That's all there is to it. Helps to look back just a little bit. So why and where's the problem? This is our budget this year, $7.6 billion. And the state budget is an interesting budget because really it's not as complicated as one might think. It's made up of three pieces. Federal funds, about 33% of our money is federal money. Over here is the permanent fund, about 20%. Is permanent fund spending, which many people don't think of as part of our budget, but it certainly is, almost to $1.4 billion. And then this is where the fiscal gap resides, is in the general fund spending. And we put a little note here where historically it's been somewhere between 68 and 90% of our general fund has been generated by oil and gas tax revenue. This year it's 87%. So when you talk about the golden goose, it's alive and well in this budget. But look here, the general fund's 34% and federal fund's 33%. That's an interesting little sidebar on this budget. But this is the home of the fiscal gap. This is where our this year's $655 million surplus resides. This is where last year our $450 million deficit resided, is in that piece. And that's the piece that we'll talk about in this presentation. Just a look back. Here we are today, the green hatch. If you look at the maroon, that's the general fund baseline. That's our general fund budget starting back in 1990, I believe that is. And you can see up and down where we are. Here we are right here, a lot of a general fund. And here it's sliding downhill out into the future. I think that's 2020. The budget itself is the white. So if white is greater than purple, we spent more. If white is less, we have a surplus. There's our $655 million. And you'll see here that starting here, this here on out, we project a 2% increase in the state budget. The blue is general fund spending when development comes in with Gasline, Anwar, and we'll see a little more of this in a moment. That's new general fund revenue. So when it hits 2012, the purple and the blue go together to be our general fund expenditure. And you'll see there with these projections that we anticipate a surplus starting in 2013. So general fund revenue can be less than general fund expenditures. That's the problem, and it can change, and it can change quickly. This is off the ledge finance, and this is a graph chart that I encourage all to have in their pocket or on their desk. Very interesting, and this is the price of oil per barrel, ANS, this axis. This is the billions of dollars in our general fund expenditures. This, of course, is below zero. This is above. So at $25 a barrel, what this tells you is that you get about $1.75 billion in unrestricted general fund revenue, that piece of the pie. And we'd have a fiscal gap of about $1 billion at $25 a barrel. This is our state expenditure. You go all the way out to 50, it tells you that you get about $2.7 billion in unrestricted general fund revenue that funds our budget, and we run a little surplus here. So that's how you read that, and you can see how quickly. Now, here we are right here. We're somewhere right in here, and we're running at about even right now. You come up at 43, and we have our little surplus. So, but as you start sliding here, just slide down. Remember the days of $30 barrel oil? We thought we were in the tall clover. $30 a barrel gives you about $700 million deficit. That, to me, is what we should be worried about as we look out in the budgets in the next 5 or 10 years. That, to me, is a structural deficit. And you can be your own guess as to where we are going to be on this continuum. But, I mean, just let history be your guide. We're going to be somewhere between here and here. So that's a slide that I think is really telling and looks out to the future. Things have changed, and they have. And, of course, in 1990, the voters wisely set out the Constitutional Budget Reserve through this Section 17 of our Constitution, Article 9, and starting in 1994 was the first year that we funded a fiscal gap with the CBR, and 8 out of the last 12 years, 2 out of 3 years, 66% of the time, we funded it out of the CBR. We've withdrawn $5.5 billion. We've put back in through settlements and earnings somewhere between $7.2 billion. So that's the CBR as we look at it today. This is an interesting chart to look backwards, back to 1994 when we first tapped the CBR. The maroon lines are the CBR balance. So back in 1998, the CBR was a touch over $3.5 billion. Today, at the end of FY05, it's projected to be just a touch over $2.4 billion. So you can see here the CBR, which since I've been here, I laugh when I say it's like the furniture store on the corner. It's been going out of business in the same location for years. But it's still pretty healthy at $2.5 billion. It's certainly 1 year of our general fund expenditure. The blue line is the draw, and you can see the number here. You can't read those, but you can in your sheet. And you can see where there is no blue line for these years where we didn't have any CBR draw. The green line is the average draw, just to take all of these boxes and divide them by 8. The average draw is $318 million, and that's just really just for your reference. Current balance is 2.1, projected to be at the end of this year. Fiscal year, 2.4. I don't need to tell this committee, certainly the chairman, that Alaska is a resource state, and we're blessed beyond imagination with oil, gas, coal, things that even though Congress didn't know it, they anticipated it back in the 50s when they said in order for Alaska to be a state, they need to develop their resources. And this is how we have and plan on doing it. This is the fiscal gap that we talked about. Here we are, 2006. This is 2011, what the administration anticipates the gas line that Senator Terrio is going to bring us. is going to add to our general fund. You can see here, and just here's Bristol Bay exploration and production, Bristol Bay. Here's ANWR. And the blue is the continual decline of existing oil fields. And as you see, the backfill as we develop our resources. And this is what we need to do, is build a bridge from here to here to get us to do that. Well, there's several ways to do it, seven different ways to do it if you're talking big money. We can reduce state spending. We've done that. Five-year plan, $250 million, plus or minus. Save a dollar, earn a dollar. Corporate taxes, name of numbers. People say $50 to $100 million if we change corporate taxes every year. Sales tax, 2 to 3%, gets you $200 or $300 million a year. Income tax, name a number again, but $400 to $600 million a year. Other revenues, we've already done tobacco taxes, alcohol taxes, rental cars, studded tires. Pick you up $50-60 million a year, and of course the CBR. And then the seventh piece, which we bring into play here, is the earnings reserve from the permanent fund. The result, of course, is of wise investment of our permanent fund. Today, $2.1 billion sitting there, according to the permanent fund. Well, in the past, as you saw earlier, we filled all this 8 out of 10 years with the CBR. And so if we continued that, given projections today, the CBR runs out in 2010. And we still have a gap here. Given 2% increase in our budget, we still have a gap that we need to bridge. So we need to call in the earnings reserve. And the question is, well, so what if we just split it between the earnings reserve and the CBR, and that's Senate Bill 88? Here's what happens. Here's our CBR that before was the red that fell off in 2010 or 2011. If we split it, obviously, it extends the CBR, and it gets us out to 2013, where we consider the gas line and more to catch up with our general fund spending, and we're on the track that we saw earlier. This is the bridge, the development that Senate Bill 88 talks about, and these are the abutments of the bridge. Well, can we do it? And folks say, well, you can't touch the earnings reserve. Well, yes, we can. And the Permanent Fund Corporation back in 98 talks about the earnings reserve and its purpose to be a major source of income when the general fund starts to falter. The earnings reserve is a result of wise investment or permanent fund. And it's not the permanent fund. We'll see that here in a moment. And it has been, and it still is, available to the legislature by a simple majority vote of 21 and 11. So yes, we can. We can tap the earnings reserve to augment the CBR. This is a chart also that everybody ought to have on their desktop, either on their computer. This is updated every month by the Permanent Fund Corporation. This gives you the status back from the beginning of the corporation to, I think it's 20. But it gives the best projections as of this date for the health of our permanent fund. And there's a lot of good information here, but we've just highlighted a couple. Expect this year 7.61 return. Today we have in the earnings reserve, cash in the bank, as a result of wise investments, $2.1 billion. If you look down here just as a sidelight, that number, and I think that's 20... Let's see, there's 95. Let's just say that's about 2020, perhaps. Anyhow, the point being, that's $47 billion right there. And we just rolled, yesterday, we rolled over $30 billion. So, and we're going to have a presentation in Senate Finance tomorrow that's going to talk about the health of the permanent fund. But one can only make the conclusion that it's very healthy. But this is a great chart, and lots of information here that I would refer you folks to. But for purposes of today, let us just say there's $2.1 billion in cash and realized earnings, and there's about $2.5 billion in unrealized earnings. It's important, and I argue with my newspaper, and I argued with one of the reporters last spring, when he said, no, there's no difference between the earnings reserve and the permanent fund, and there's absolutely a difference, governed by two different rules. The principal today, $27.2 billion. Today, the earnings reserve account, $3.3 billion before we pay dividends and inflation proof. This is protected, as you well know, by the Constitution. We won't touch that until the people vote. And when the people vote to touch this, surely the legislators ahead of us, legislatures and TORs, will have done a poor job to drive anybody to ever touch this. This is available. This is available by different rules, 21 and 11. This is the result of wise investments. And as we very well know, this is funded by special deposits, which the legislature can claim somewhere around 9 or 11 billion put into there. This is oil and gas revenues that flow out of resource developments, Section 10 of our Constitution, that gets 25% of rents and royalties to flow into this, with except MPRA, which operates under a different set of rules than the rest of oil and gas, but that's a subject for another day. We dump it in here, we invest it, and this is to the benefit of the people of Alaska with a majority vote. And that is what we talk about when we talk about the earnings reserve. We're not raiding the permanent fund. We're using the earnings of the permanent fund generated by wise investment. I think it's really important to stop, and we laugh about it, but it's very serious. I think it's important for all of Alaskans to stop and just think for the moment that we're the only government in America. We're the only people in America, and one of a handful of governments in the world, that is trying to figure out how to manage $32 billion for the benefit of 650,000 people. You just need to stop and think what that means. An investment that started in 1975, 30 years later, has $32 billion in it to manage, to benefit 650,000 people. I say to the finance and others, you know, you just push back from the table and rub your bellies. We got it so good. And I think that's an important concept to remember. And then you put on top of that the earnings reserve account. And where does the earnings reserve come from? It comes from us investing our money. But people around the world are investing in the same things that we invest in. And they're not investing in it to lose money, although many have, me included. But overall, people invest in corporate America through equities, because we know equities are going to grow. They invest in America's society by investing in real estate across America. They invest in America's future by investing in bonds. Every minute, every hour, every day, there are millions of people from around the world that are investing in what we're investing in, and when they invest their dollar, it drives our earnings reserve up a tick and drives the monies available to help us when needed. So if you put those two things together, the earnings reserve and the CBR, that's the bridge to development. But people say, well, you can't touch the earnings reserve account. It's gonna ruin my permanent fund check. I mean, everybody has heard it over and over and over. So we asked the question, if we had a $500 million structural deficit in our general fund, there it is, and we split it 50-50, what is the effect on our permanent fund dividend check, given the slide we saw back earlier, the projections for the permanent fund, the best you can project, what's the effect? The first year on a dividend check to fill a $500 million deficit is less than a dollar. 5 years out, the effect of that decision is $30 on every permanent fund check. $30. Those numbers, when we first saw those last spring, were, I guess the word was unbelievable. But they're good numbers. They've been scrubbed, double scrubbed, and we can take that chart to the bank. And in fact, I think each of you today have a little card like this, a little plastic card. On one side is the bridge to development, why we want to fill the fiscal gap, how, and this is the effect of doing it with a CBR ERA draw. Stick that in your wallet, and after you show folks that, they still don't believe you, then have them call me. So slide 18 is critical to this, to the defense that we're going to erode the permanent fund dividend check. Here's our $300 million up here. We've had, remember, $310 million over the last 12 years, average deficit? We split it $18 over in the first 5 years, cumulative effect on your check. Slide 18 is a very important slide. Ken?
How do you want to do this? If you have questions, I want to make sure that I understand, Senator Wilken. Are you talking about when you look at the out years, the net effect on a permanent fund dividend check, are those out year numbers based on 1 year's draw of 250,
yes,
or are they based on several years' draw of 250? So if, for example, you had to draw 250 over four fiscal years, could we assume that it would be four times $30?
Roughly, yes. That's the result of one. That is the result of 1 year's decision.
And you can see it cumulative across. You've got $3 plus $9 is $12, plus 18 is $30. So it's, when you get out to the 30 years, that's for all 5 years. It's not $30 impact in that year's check. That's 5 years worth of impact added together, total of $30.
That's correct. Thank you. And you're right. And I didn't emphasize that. That's exactly right. So.
But that's important to say that one more time, because that's escape shift.
That $30 is the cumulative effect of a decision made. If we had to decide to balance the 06 budget with $250 million out of the earnings reserve, which we know today is $2.1 billion, 5 years from now, the cumulative effect of that decision would be a permanent fund check that is cumulative $30 less than all five checks. Cumulatively would be $30 less. I said that wrong the first time.
You really have to point that out to people, because...
And I said it wrong the first time, and Senator is exactly right. So slide 18 is an important slide. And this is sort of shows in a different way. How much less is my permanent fund check if the legislature withdraws $250 million from the ERA every year for 10 years? And the effect here is that is 110. And let me check for a minute here. I don't think this slide's right. Sheila, is it? We're going to come back to this. I don't think this slide is right, given what we just talked about earlier. This is my first presentation on this slide. I'm going to come back to this, because I don't think this is right. Yeah, let me come back to this, because I need to work on that one. Let's look at alternative revenue sources. You know, when people talk to me and other folks, they say, well, you know, we need a long-term fiscal plan. And so the first thing that always pops up is, well, we need an income tax. And I say, well, why? And the answer is, well, because everybody has it. And not everybody, but six other states don't. But if we did an income tax on a family of four with adjusted income of $57,000, it would cost that family about $1,000. According to the Department of Revenue, a sales tax at 2.75%, given this is based on the sales tax we dealt with last year, same family, $57,000 adjusted gross income, about $950 a year. The earnings reserve, back to slide 18, in year two is going to cost a family of four times three, which is $12. I know which one I'm going to pick if I have to pick one of those to fund government. I'd rather take 12 out of my family's checkbook than 1,000 or 950. What about over time? You can see here that an income tax, which we talked about, from FY06 to here would cost a family $9,000. A sales tax multiplied would be $8,500. Here's the earnings reserve would cost $1,940, and that's right. That's if we would draw $250 million every year for 10 years.
Your figures aren't due pure numbers either. They aren't figuring what it would cost the state to collect an income tax or a sales tax or anything. That isn't added into your numbers, is it?
No, just the cost that comes out of family checkbook. So you can see here, this is the power of the earnings. To use this, this is what a family would pay if we use 50-50 earnings reserve and CBR. This is what they pay if we just do it the traditional method, like every other other states do it. And it's obvious. It's obvious what the power of the earnings brings to the families of Alaska. And of course, just logic would tell you that it extends the CBR by twice, by double. And you can see here, as on the slope we're at today, the CBR runs out somewhere around FY09 in here. If we split it, of course, it gets out further and further and hits out about FY12, 13. And so it obviously extends the CBR by a double. Again, with an increase in our budget of 2%. I think an important concept here is that one of the things I didn't like about the PMV is that you just had a ton of money dropped into your account, whether you needed it or not. And I think that using the earnings reserve sets up a one-on-one relationship with the voter. And let's use an example. Let's just say last year we funded the deficit at the time we left was $400 million. And we funded 20 new troopers, record increase in education, $1.6 billion capital fund. We kept intact the social service safety net that we have. And that would have cost, going back to slide 18, would have cost a dollar or $2. People that would challenge me that I diminished their permanent fund check or I raided the permanent fund, I would stand up and say, yes, you know, we did all those things, troopers, education, public health and safety, big capital budget, and we did it for $4. If this legislature, years from now, goes crazy and spends money on bridges to nowhere or programs that are not sustainable, and we become a welfare state, for want of a better word, and we go home and we say, yeah, we did all those things, and it cost you $37, and my opponent in the primary or my opponent in the general can put a case to the voter that I wasted their earnings, I wasted their permanent fund money, that's something I have to defend, and you defend it to the dollar. It's a piece that is arguable in public, and one has to stand up for the person that spent it, and and the person that thinks you spent it unwisely, your opponent. It's a very political issue, and it should be political because we're spending the people's money, and the earnings reserve is their money, and we have to defend how we dipped into the earnings reserve to fund their government. And it's a number that can be quantified, defended, or attacked, however you'd like to do it. But it sets up that tension between the voter and the elected official. And the important thing is we're only going to do it when it's needed. We're not going to do it if we have a surplus. We don't talk about this. We only talk about this, Senate Bill 88, in times of fiscal need. So the next two slides are just a summary. What I consider to be the foot stomps in this. This state obviously has to drive itself to natural resource development, and we have done it. We have $32 billion in the bank as a result of that and wise investment. We'll continue to do that through responsible oil development across Alaska. We'll continue to do it by driving a good deal. One of these days we will have a gas line. It recognizes the power of the earnings reserve. It recognizes that people, millions of people every day are investing what Alaska invests in, and as their investments, their optimism drives our investments, and that benefit falls to the people of Alaska. It builds the bridge until we can experience the development that this budget certainly recognizes and future budgets will. It establishes the accountability by forming this relationship between the voter and the user and the spender, so to speak. It minimizes, you go back to the dividend check, it minimizes the impact on Alaska's family It doubles the life of the CBR. We have preliminary indications that it strengthens Alaska's bond rating, saves millions of dollars in bond issuance and bond payments. And lastly, I think it provides Alaska with a stable and defendable long-term fiscal plan. With that, I say thank you. And I'm available to answer questions. Again, thanks for your time and for your attention.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Elton has to step out for a subcommittee meeting. Senator Wilken, the, I guess, question off the top of my head is the necessity of passage of this wording. If we had a shortage this year, simple majority vote, we could go use some earnings. And of course, we have the three-quarters vote attached to the CBR, but we don't need this language in order to do that. And in fact, if you had this language on the books in the future and a legislature chose not to use this blend of funds, they could ignore this language because the power of appropriation always trumps. So I guess what do you see as the real utility of placing this language in the book?
There's two answers to your question. First is it is policy, and policy can be ignored. So having said that, I think it's worth our while when things are good to talk about what we consider to be the future and what it holds. And I think this type of discussion, whether it's this or PMV or it's other things that are going to come up in the next few weeks, I think it fosters the discussion. And whether this passes or not this year, I care not. I do care about the fact that we don't lull ourselves into thinking that the gravy years are going to continue. And that sometime when we're faced, as we have been, I mean, I think back to 1999, when this building was galvanized, was paralyzed by $10 barrel oil, I'd like for people to think that there's a way out, a relatively simple way out that doesn't turn first to the people's, to the family's checkbook or their savings account. It doesn't turn first to the companies that have chosen to invest in us as a state. But there's options out there, and this is one of them. And the time to talk about these is not under the pressure of $500 million or $1 billion of fiscal gaps. The time to talk about this is now, when we have the time and the luxury of time. So I understand it's policy, follow it if you like. But to get us to that point, we have to have the discussion that starts with this committee today.
Certainly. In fact, earlier today, people were asking me whether the legislature was working on the fiscal issue. And I told them that your bill was had a hearing today. The trustees asked that the pure POMV be put back on the table for discussion. Senator Stevens has a bill that's back in the hopper for discussion. It's just not generating the headlines like it did last year. And to tell you the truth, I think it affords us the opportunity to have this reasoned discussion about the policy and not have people be spooked one way or another. So that's a good thing. But, and I guess we have gotten to the point that people are saying, well, what is the fiscal plan? You could have given this presentation without legislation. You could have said, we've got a fiscal plan. We've got the building blocks to handle our fiscal situation. And it's the same blend before passage of this legislation, but I guess what this does is say, well, we have considered our different options, and we think using these blocks and this mechanism is a good policy. And so there's some benefit to going to doing that. And even though it can be set aside or ignored in the future, I think there is some potential benefit. So I know that you rolled this out last year, and I think you've developed the concept a little bit further. What kind of questions did you have through the interim with regards to this? Or as you went through your election, what discussion was there?
There was some attempt there was some attempt to use this as a sword or a bomb. I've found the concept surprisingly well received. When I first came here, the thought of touching the earnings reserve was a third rail issue. I just suggest that it isn't that issue that it used to be, and that folks that stop for a moment and just look at it and see what it really is and understand that we're the only state that has it, that it rubs the edges off the demagogues that want to talk about raiding the permanent fund and stealing from the future. It's absolutely 180, and I quite frankly, Senator, I was refreshed when my opponent would bring up the opportunity to talk about me raiding the permanent fund, and I then had the opportunity to say why not. And I, not only did I win the election, I won that battle. And I think that many will have that same experience as they talk more and more about it, which I hope that this fosters that discussion.
Have you and your staff or anyone else sort of sat around just thinking of the possible unintended consequences? And because it's statutory, unlike the current wording on the Constitution Budget Reserve, the potential for that is much diminished. But certainly when the Constitution Budget Reserve was first passed, the three-quarters vote, I think the talk in this building was that was a mechanism to keep the level of spending down. Of course, we know that it's actually been used to drive spending up. In fact, last year, as we got to the final package, negotiating out the three-quarters vote, talking to one of the minority leaders in the building here in this very room, sort of laid out the plan. It's $12.5 million, basically, for the three-quarters vote. Told him what had all come together with discussions on the House side, the Senate side. And the comment to me was, well, nice start, you owe me another $10 million. The general public doesn't really have an idea, nor when they approved that language, did they really think about that unintended consequence of the three-quarters vote driving spending up. Have you just sat in your office and just thought about, well, how could this go astray? What's the potential downside? What is there that we haven't thought of?
I think the thing I hear most is that, well, it depends on the stock market. And, you know, you go back to that slide. If we had another bear market like we did, which was unprecedented in the last 70 years, if we had a bear market and $10 barrel oil, we're going to have trouble coming up with the money. But those things would have to happen in concert, you know, and that's the way the stock market works. At the same time, it could go the other way, and I highlighted that in 2020 or 2018, there's $47 billion sitting there. It could go the other way, and you're right. I have a great deal of faith in Wall Street and the stock market, and that faith has been proven out for many people over decades. So I'll go with that. That's been the one that pops up the most. Frankly, from a political standpoint, I've never been, as I've gotten involved in this process, I'm not a big fan of the CBR, and the Halford decision bastardized that original concept. And so the CBR, the three-quarter vote, bastardizes our budget process. But I thought it's important to extend the CBR out to the time that we will have resource development money. And frankly, from a political standpoint, it preserves the minority's leverage to do the things they have done. They're still players in the budget process, albeit it's a little different than other legislatures. So I think those are the things that probably pop up the most. Those two things.
Well, the issue of do other members have questions?
Oh, go ahead.
The issue of the perfect storm, low prices for oil and stock market down, that would put a constraint on the money that you have. I mean, one of the pillars in your bridge could end up being a little shorter than you expected, but it it doesn't, it sort of self-corrects. You'd have a gap there that you'd have to figure out how to fill it or cut spending, but it's not like you would be able to get access to additional earnings that are not there.
So. We would be in 1999 land, you know, with, although we did have the, we did have a few billion in the CBR then, but yeah, I mean, that's the perfect storm that could happen, but the chances of it happening are far less than an increasing stock market and a strong American economy or world economy.
Having come through the market dip that we did, of course, everybody's dividend has been suppressed because of that, but now we're back to over $30 billion in the permanent fund. So, I mean, we've come through, as you said, the worst market since the crash of 29, and it's rebounded, as the experts tell us that it will statistically, and the fund continues to grow, and, you know, onward we march.
Back in those bad years in 2000, 2001, yeah, we did poorly, but we still had a positive return. They did a wonderful job in those years. But
Senator Wagner?
First, you don't do poorly unless you sell your stock. I mean, there really isn't a loss to you sell it. And I think we did pretty good, whether it didn't panic. Second thing is, the one thing I don't like about this bill, it still doesn't negate the ability of either minority using the CBR to increase the expenditure on the budget each year. I myself would rather take the entire amount out of the earnings account than I would the CBR to avoid that vote. But having said that, I would really rather eliminate the CBR so we didn't have to worry about dealing with the CBR and then use this process with a single deduction of money from it. So that's where I'd come from on this. I mean, I applaud what you've done, because it's got a lot of thought in it, and it's creating a lot of thought, I'm sure, a lot of people discussing it.
Senator, I thank you for the handout. You know, as I have constituent meetings, this would be a good thing to pull out and, you know, to show to people. But I think if you continue to use the slide or continue to use this handout, you need to clarify how these are cumulative. Because when you get out to year 10, it's $110, and people say, well, geez, you're going to be taking $110 out of every member of my family's check on a yearly basis. But it really, it's cumulative over a 10-year period.
Thank you for clarifying that. This is the first presentation, so we're stumbling through it.
Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Wilkins, I characterize this in my own mind rationally as kind of a red flare fired for conversation. And I mean, I certainly don't necessarily support this, but I celebrate the fact that you fired that flare and we're having this conversation. So I'd be less candid. Last week when you fired the flare, it was only a few feet down the hall that I heard some people talking. They were characterizing this as Gary Wilkin raiding the permanent fund. So, and you know how that,
oh, yeah,
how that happens. And I think it's also fair to say that the average person in Alaska probably is not ready to accept this conclusion just based on where we are. But the fact that you fired the flare, I say good for you. Now, to be frank, my concern about us Alaskans is that over time, because we defaulted on just about everything that was laid on the table, that we might end up with an income tax because nobody wanted a sales tax or this or that. I don't like any kind of tax, so let me make sure that everybody understands that. But that for some reason we would spring-load to the default position, and we would come to the conclusion that, my goodness, maybe an income tax would be good for us. I don't support that. But having this conversation, and this will cause other conversations to emanate out, and over time, what better news can we have? As you said, we go over $30 billion in the permanent fund when just a few years ago we were worried about, was the stock market ever going to return back to its feet? Not bad. So thank you very much.
My newspaper, when I dropped the bill in my newspaper a week ago Friday, the headline on the front page, it wasn't a headline, it was one of the main articles on the front page, it said, Wilkin, : tap permanent fund, tap perm fund to fill fiscal gaps.
I mean, and that's, you know, that's the slide. It isn't the permanent fund. It's the result of the permanent fund. But the demagogues, I mean, it has already started. They want to talk about raiding the permanent fund. And so that's just something you got to fight through, Senator, and that's just, we'll do that because we need to focus on the power of the earnings.
Senator, is there anything else in the packet here that you want to bring to the members' attention to really highlight? I see we have a color copy of the presentation, so if we want to look at any of the charts, it's here.
We'll have up, we'll have this. We've got the old plan on the website, and the new one will be up here probably by the end of the week. So it'll be a PDF file that be in color that can be downloaded wherever you want. Sheila's going to make up some DVDs, so we may have a half a dozen of those for somebody that might want to have it for whatever reason. The little cards, we can make all you want of those, and for reference. And other than that, that's going to be the teaching materials. So just let us know. We can do all that. And I've offered to different groups, RDC, State Chamber. I've said, you know, you want me to come and talk about this, or any of us come and talk about whatever we're having. Well, we have the luxury of time to talk about it, I'll be more than happy to do it. So it's sort of it's a work in progress, and I wouldn't characterize it as a red flare, but perhaps a green flare. So.
Okay, we're going to set Senate Bill 88 aside, give members of the committee time to chat further with Senator Wilken. It will be one of the bills that can come up under bills previously heard at some time in the future.
Thank you again for your time and your attention.
I'd like now to, why don't we take just a brief break so we can move some of the electronics here, and then we will take up Senate Concurrent Resolution number 2, and we'll come back in just, why don't we say 5 minutes. Let's go back on the record, please, and let's turn our attention to Senate Concurrent Resolution number 2. Spokesperson, staff to the prime sponsor.
My name is Melanie Lesh. I'm staff to Senator Gary Wilkins, who is at the ASME board meeting. He couldn't be here.
Senator Gary Wilkins?
Senator Gary Stevens. Sorry.
Oh.
That was some close association. Senator Gary Stevens is the sponsor of the resolution to proclaim 2005 as International Rotary International Year. And I know that many of you are familiar with Rotary. I've seen your faces at some of the local Rotary meetings, and I have with me Assistant District Governor Craig Dahl, who can speak and testify to the bill, to the resolution.
Okay. Are there questions for the prime sponsor staff? No, thank you very much. If you just introduce yourself and your affiliation, please.
Yes. Good afternoon. My name is Craig Dahl, and I am the Assistant District Governor for District 5010, which is all of Alaska, Yukon, and Eastern Russia. And I'm really here on behalf of all the members of our Rotarians in our district to thank the members of the Senate for acknowledging 100 years of service by Rotary International. We have the opportunity, or I should say I've had the opportunity, to serve Rotary for more than 26 years, and in particular for this district, which is the most unique Rotary district in the world. We're the largest district by virtue of our geography. All of eastern Russia, east of the Ural Mountains, the Yukon Territories, and Alaska. So we have over 6 million square miles of territory to cover. We serve 35 Rotary clubs in Alaska, Yukon, and another 35 clubs in the Russian eastern Russia. So there's over 2,600 Rotarians throughout the district providing community service in an exemplary manner. Our district is used as a model for a number of programs used throughout the Rotary world, in particular our foundation fundraising and our youth exchange program. We have an interesting opportunity to serve the fourth object of Rotary, which is fostering international peace, understanding, and goodwill. This year in particular with a district governor who is the first Russian district governor of Rotary International. And so it's given those of us in the state of Alaska and the Yukon to work very closely with our friends in Russia on a variety of community service projects. I think that statewide in particular, you would see during the centennial year a tremendous effort going into a variety of projects and fundraising that has targeted at youth and different service programs. probably one of the highlights would be the Awake Shelter in Anchorage, where all of the Anchorage Rotary Clubs, in concert with the Rasmussen Foundation, has constructed the teen center up there. You've seen in Whitehorse, for example, the Centennial Bridge, which is spanning the Yukon River, really is a joint project between the Rotary Clubs up there and the Yukon government. Very aggressive. They've been at it for more than 2 years. And if you were to travel around southeast and the westward part of Alaska, you'd see a number of community service projects improving various recreational facilities, most of them targeted at youth. And I also think the important factor for Rotary is all the scholarships that are raised throughout the state. And our contribution to Rotary International, this year alone, this Rotary group will have raised over $280,000 that is leveraged against the Rotary Foundation for projects not just in Alaska, but also in other foreign countries. I'm pleased and proud to be a member of Rotary, and I would just simply like to thank, again, the members of the Senate for acknowledging 100 years of service above self. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have questions? Senator Wagner.
I was just going to have Mr. Dahl expand on one thing. You might explain the Interact clubs and how they operate between the Rotary clubs and the high schools.
We have an excellent opportunity to join both Interact clubs at the high school level, as well as what we call Rotaract clubs, which is oftentimes joined with the university. It gives us an opportunity to bring youth at the high school level in contact with the different Rotary clubs in their respective areas and basically get them entrenched in the concept of service above self and community service, which is maybe sometimes missing. And it's been a lot of fun to see the different joint projects in that area and gets them primed and ready to be a good Rotarian in the years to come.
Just so you know, I'm Paul Harris Scholar, fellow.
Twice, I think.
Good.
Can you tell me the what's the level of participation in the clubs in the state of Alaska? There's a thought that nationwide participation in service clubs has fallen off the moose, the elks. In fact, there's an author that's written a book called Bowling Alone, that those groups and, you know, organizations that were part of the fabric of the U.S. For the last, say, 50 years, there's been some fall off in participation. But my sense is that Rotary in particular has pretty much maintained
participation. I think that the answer to that is that, first of all, Rotary is growing, is a growing organization. And I think that the ideal of Rotary, meaning that it's a group of professional men and women focused on community service, it isn't based on any other particular bond. And I think that the bond of community service, basically harnessing the horsepower of the business community to get a job done for the benefit of those that can't, is a very powerful motivating tool. And we have no trouble encouraging members to join Rotary. And I think in Alaska, and maybe that's the reason why our district ends up being an example for many of the programs, is because I think the spirit of living in Alaska and what we do together is almost typifies the spirit of Rotary. So.
Can you give me an idea of the amount of participation in your exchange program as far as Alaskans going abroad?
The Alaskans, I don't have the exact number this year, but basically of the 35 clubs area-wide, we sent out, I believe we're sending out almost 40 or 41 exchange students this year. This is a tremendous program. And basically the way this, of course, works is for every student that we sponsor to go out, we also bring one student in. So we have the opportunity to exchange over 40 young men and women in various countries around the world. And it's a very, very strong tool.
Yeah, I think that's a great part of your program. My wife and I have hosted three different inbound students, and my godson just got back from a year in Russia, now speaks Russian. So that's going to be benefit to him in his life. He's thinking about how he puts that to good use. And
their lifelong friendships.
Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm glad you mentioned the exchange part of it, because in my estimation, I know there's a number of people involved in Rotary here in the building and at this table, but if Rotary ceased to exist other than steady state on the freeze position, for lack of a better term, and we continued the youth exchange program, I think it would be as great a contribution as anyone or any group could make because of the international relationship portion. And my experience with Rotary is when you take the students that are inbound to the United States, that when you get groups of exchange from Rotary and you name how they got here as exchange students, that the persons that are Rotary exchange students inbound from other countries are held, they're a little higher on the pedestal of, I wish I was a Rotary exchange student by some of the others, if you will. So Rotary just amongst the peer groups of exchange students has is kind of held up on a pedestal. That's a good thing. And as I look at it, having, like Senator Terrio, hosted some people, there are so many satellite benefits that you can't imagine. And I was just talking to a lady that was the coordinator of exchange students at Colony High School here recently, and she was telling me over the last 5 years how many different families she had gone to their country based on their invitation to maintain that friendship. She's multilingual based on working in the exchange program as a as a coordinator in the school. So I'd say thank you very much, and I think we can't say enough about the exchange program. And everything else stands on its own merit and is a great thing in its own right. So I say good for you, and I'm proud that we're making this resolution happen.
Well, thank you. And just one final comment. I think one of the most exciting events is to see 40 prepared outbound students ready to go, 40 inbound foreign exchange students already here, and 40 what we call rebound students who have already come and gone. And when you see over 100 young people who have already shared or preparing to share an international experience, that's what it's all about. So, and again, thank you very much for taking the time. I promise not to ask anything from the CBR. And
one non-related question for you here, let me put you on the hot seat a little bit. Have you ever, in the program for the outbound students, have they ever expressed a concern that in traveling abroad they lose their dividend for a year, or do they in fact lose their dividend?
No, it has been discussed, and they do not lose their.
Okay.
They're generally not gone long enough to do that.
Okay. The I've looked through the resolution. I don't have any concerns with any of the wording. Any of the wording on the whereases or the resolve, is there?
Yes.
Senator Huggins.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate concurrent resolution number 2 be moved.
There is a motion to move the resolution from committee with individual recommendations. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the resolution will move from committee. Yes, along with the if there's no objection, the 1-0 fiscal note. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, next we will take up Executive Order 113. Executive Order 113. Kevin, come forward. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kevin Brooks. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration, and here to talk to you about Executive Order number 113, which would transfer the authorities of the TIC, as they are currently in statute, the Telecommunications Information Council, to the Department of Administration. And really, this is something that, in my mind, is really a kind of a cleanup type of an action. The TIC was established in the late 80s. Some of the issues of the day were whether government should use Macs or PCs. And it was established really for government to kind of get a handle and kind of proceed in a orderly fashion. And it was comprised of the cabinet, the commissioner of each department, as well as a couple members from the legislature appointed and and it served a function and met often in its early years. But in recent years, it really hasn't, and we're trying to determine when their most recent meeting was, and I think there was one meeting in about 2001 or two, but it really has been sporadic in recent years. It kind of evolved into a TIC executive committee, which in previous administrations was a handful of commissioners with either an interest or an expertise working with the Department of Administration and the Office of Management and Budget. And currently, what the administration has done is really kind of taken a proactive approach to IT, information technology, and telecommunications and government. We have state agencies now doing annual IT plans, identifying both human resources and other assets that are devoted to this function. There's a planning process, a review process that exists that with representatives from every department, although maybe more appropriately placed with administrative services directors and IT managers within those departments, and then raising those to a level where they get reviewed by the governor's office and Office of Management and Budget. And so the duties currently are being performed in the Department of Administration, and this executive order would appropriately transfer them to reflect current practice.
I'm sure you're aware there's some concern on behalf of the legislature about the advisability of the legislature as a separate branch of government being swept in
right
under this. On page 2, lines 25 through 28 is the first reference to the legislature. However, throughout the bill, there is reference to the legislature. Can you speak to the advisability of, you know, having the legislature swept in, and why here on those lines 25 through 28, it's clear here that it does not mean the Alaska Railroad Corporation. So you've got a quasi corporation that is excluded specifically, and you've also got the judicial branch, the other third branch of government, specifically excluded. Why were things decided to draw the line so that some were on one side of the line and others not?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as you know, the executive order, we can't enact substantive legislation. This merely restates the statutes as they currently are written, and that is how the original TIC statutes were written. We certainly have no intent here to try and usurp authority or dictate what's appropriate for the legislative branch in terms of IT. In fact, I think we have a good collaborative relationship with Pam Varney and her staff on IT issues, but we certainly would not be opposed to a bill that would clearly identify that the legislative branch is not subject to, you know, policies that the Department of Administration would develop. But I think it would take legislation to clarify that one point.
Okay, so it's your position then that if sweeping the legislature in was not your intent, and right now you're right, they work together on the current TIC, but we have voting members, we have seats at the table, and under this mechanism, that's diminished. You were not able to exclude the legislature in the executive order format?
That's my understanding, and I think Kevin Jardel from the governor's legislative offices here could address that specifically, but it is my understanding that the executive order merely takes existing statutes and transfers them, that we couldn't change or alter those in a substantive way. But it's not our desire to change a working relationship that currently exists, but it would take a separate bill, I think, to exclude the legislature similarly to how the court system is handled, or the railroad for that matter.
Do committee members have any further questions for Kevin?
No.
Well, we have the other Kevin come forward then, since you've been offered up.
Yeah.
So I think you were in the room when I asked the question. Why was the decision made to use the executive order, and were you limited in where you could draw the line? that you had to sweep the legislature in under the executive.
The chair, Kevin Jardel, legislative director for Governor Murkowski. When we looked at it, the executive order, as you know, is a constitutional authority of the governor that's efficient in transferring and restructuring the executive branch. It's there for us to look at the structure that we need to be efficient and to easily do that, and then go before the legislature to allow them to look at it and ensure that it's something that they approve of or not disapprove of. And so it's an efficient method of going forward with a transfer of functions within the executive branch, and that's why we chose it. When we looked at the current statute and the current way we were doing things, they were too bureaucratic, too unwieldy, and that's why we haven't met in 4 years. I know some people have said that under the current tick, the legislature has, I think, one voting member, has two non-voting members, but realistically with, you know, a 17-member committee that hasn't met in 4 years, we didn't perceive the legislature power or authority diminishing since we don't actively use this process. And so we're really recognizing the process that we've been utilizing for the past 2 years, which is through the Department of Administration with consultation of LAA and other members. When we looked at whether or not we could exclude the legislature, Department of Law decided we could not, that the legislature itself had put themselves in, and that would be a substantive change that would be outside the scope of an executive order. And so we had to follow the current legislation and transfer all of the duties to the department. And like Kevin Brooks stated before, we certainly, when looking at it, had some questions as to why the legislature would have put itself in the first place. Seems to be a conflict of separation of powers there. And we would certainly support the legislature removing itself from that mandatory authority, anything that was supportive or generally encouraged cooperation among the branches would be welcome, but we see no reason to have any mandatory language between the branches.
And how about one quasi-independent corporation versus another, the permanent fund versus the railroad versus ADA versus the aerospace?
The administration 2 years ago began an implementation of a new IT policy and plan, which was an enterprise level plan. And so we look at the state executive branch on the enterprise level, trying to create as many similarities and trying to utilize the same technologies as much as practical, to gain the efficiency of the state. That enterprise level has been very effective in choosing some new technologies. When we go through this, independent or quasi-independent agencies, they're still within the executive branch. It still makes sense to have those discussions to where we can see, is there something we can piggyback on that they're utilizing or that they can piggyback on to something that we're utilizing so that the people of Alaska see the real benefit. Those discussions have been very productive. Often with HFC, or Permanent Fund Corp, those discussions lead to exemptions or waivers from the enterprise plan. When those make sense, we certainly grant those. But the discussion is important to ensure that the people are getting the maximum benefit of the technology we're purchasing.
Okay, so if we were starting from scratch, would you have the railroad be out? Or it appears in the executive order because that's the way it currently is?
That's the way it currently is. I would not suggest we change the way the railroad is treated. They have not been a part of our current process. And because of that, I don't feel comfortable suggesting that we include them. But the other agencies have been a part of our process, and we found it to be productive, although not always productive in finding similarities to utilize synergies, but productive in the discussions.
Okay, so realizing the executive order is an efficient way for the administration to sort of rearrange the boxes. But now that we've got this problem of the legislature, independent branch of government, being swept in and opposition to that, did you consider going the legislative route and approach anybody on legislation to do this so that we could have that separation?
Through the chair, we did not. We thought the best policy was to move forward with creating the system and recognizing the system that we have in place and allowing the legislature, if they so choose, to change the former policy of the administration basically having that authority, that they could do so, that we would not go to the legislature and say, you know, here's the perfect world and here's what we think you should do. We decided to go at it as here's what we think we need an executive branch, and if the legislature chooses to change the way they want to do things, we're very open to working with them to exclude themselves.
Okay, so if the executive order goes, and let's see, we have 45 days to disapprove? Is that?
By the 60th day.
60, okay. 60 to disapprove, take action
yes.
by independent resolution that disapproves, then if we don't, then it kicks in. If that kicks in, this takes effect, and we pass a piece of legislation to separate ourselves out, we can go at it that way, or you can introduce a piece of legislation just to make the separation without the executive order.
Through the chair, you could. You could, if you were to disapprove the executive order, then you could introduce legislation to change the whole methodology and recognize what we've done, the EO, through legislation. The legislative process, we think, would delay things, and you get into a situation of trying to spend resources on really just recognizing the current process that we have. We think this is a more efficient method. This is a constitutional authority of the governor to utilize this to rearrange and restructure the executive branch, and we think it's appropriate in this instance for us to go forward with restructuring the executive branch how we think it best and most efficient. And if the legislature chooses to introduce legislation to remove itself, like I said, we would very much support that.
Questions from committee members? Okay, thank you, Kevin. We have also Pam Varney, the Legislative Affairs Agency.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Pam Varney. I'm Executive Director of the Legislative Affairs Agency. I've been a member of the TIC, the Telecommunications Information Council, since 1993. And I'm under the Lieutenant Governor Fran Ulmer. She was very active as the chair of the TIC, and I'm unaware since that time that there have been meetings. Those meetings were beneficial, I feel, to the legislature, in that that was our opportunity to know just what the executive branch was doing, to bring our point of view across, and also sometimes we would be collaborating on things, whether it was video teleconferencing, with the University of Alaska, with the executive branch, and with the legislative branch. So it was all of us meeting at the table. As you know, Legislative Council sets policy. And years ago, Legislative Council standardized hardware and software for the legislature. A short time after that, the TIC brought up this same subject so that we would be standardized and could exchange files between the executive branch departments, between the executive branch and the legislature. So I think some decisions were made that were good, where the judicial branch and the legislative branch and the executive branch were together. I feel that Executive Order 113 really, that there is a problem with the separation of powers. And they've added some new sections that include the legislature. It would be interesting to find out whether our attorneys feel that this executive order could be withdrawn and inserted a new one that would separate us out. We've had a great relationship with the executive branch. We currently are on the statewide wide area network. We have no problems in collaborating and getting along with the Office of the Governor, the Lieutenant Governor, the Department of Administration. So we want to do that, but we would like these sections changed in that we don't believe how it is drafted that it would be good that we have to go to the Commissioner of Administration to have him in writing approve things that we want to do just maybe a little bit differently. It also would be beneficial, I think, if a section would be added that the Commissioner of Administration would notify the Administrative Director of the court system and the Executive Director of the Legislative Affairs Agency. We have no problem with the TIC moving from the Office of the Governor to the Department of Administration, but we'd like to know what possible changes they would be making so that they keep us informed so that we have a chance to plan and to react to those changes. And I would urge either the Governor's office to pull this executive order and resubmit it with the changes that I have mentioned, or for our legislature to look at disapproving this executive order and having some legislation that would have sections in it like the court system has. And then we have the ability, if we want to do things with the Department of Administration, that we can do that, but not that we're under their umbrella.
So, Pam, have you conferred with our legal department, and you believe that just withdrawing the executive order and resubmitting it would allow us the latitude to make the separation, or that you would also need legislation?
Haven't asked Pam Cook that question. So I'm sure that Kevin Jardel was conferring with his attorneys at Department of Law. The thing is when this was written, when we were under with the executive branch, that was back in 1972. We probably had two or three data processing people, and we used the mainframe computer. After that, we had our own mainframe computer, and now we're on client servers. So we still use some of the programs on the mainframe, our accounting system, our payroll system, but I'm not sure about that question, and I'd like to pursue that a little bit further if
okay.
we could.
And as far as consistency in the legislature now, I mean, we've come through this tremendous explosion of technology. I mean, even when I started here, a floppy disk was the size of a small pizza, and now, of course, you can get probably 10,000 times as much on a thumbnail. We've come through the, are we going to do Macintosh, are we going to do PCs? Is it your feeling that the legislature pretty much has control of that through Leg Affairs on what technology we're, you know, hitching our bus to and to go forward? And then also, do you feel assured that there would still be enough give and take back between the administration and the legislature? Because it's those two branches of government that I see do have to collaborate more on the video teleconferencing. We don't do a whole lot of that with the court system utilizing their facilities, but we do more of that with the administration. So what's your feeling that if that separation were twofold? Within our own house, we've gotten consistency, and if we do have separation with the administration, there'll still be enough of a connection there to maintain the required consistency with the executive.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I believe that we have a sufficient staffing levels in our data processing section to keep up with the programs and to support the legislature. If we feel that the executive branch is offering something that we would also like to participate in, I believe we can partner with them, and because we are the smallest branch of government. We only have 500 or so employees. And so lots of times we will want to look at what the executive branch is doing and see if it is in our best interest to join with them and participate. But we also need our own autonomy. If we decide to buy a certain type of machine, we don't want to have to go and ask the executive branch for permission to do that.
Okay. And is it an issue of buying new technology or a new machine? Or once something is approved, would you have to get approval to buy another one of those machines, or just when you're bringing something new into the mix?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it would be something that would be new into the mix.
Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, just makes me realize and what a delightful country we live in. Some countries that some of us have visited and lived in, the conversation would not be about administrative orders. It would be a concern of the legislature assassinating the king or taking over tomorrow and there's conspiring the building next door. And here we are. What a great position to be in that we're just talking about incursion into separation of powers. But, so we sometimes have to change ourselves about how wonderful it is. But be that as it may, we must tackle the subject. So.
Okay, further questions for Ms. Varney? We also have Kurt Clothier. Actually, I see, Kurt, you're here to answer questions. Did you have you heard anything that needs clarification? Okay, come forward.
For the record, my name is Curtis Clothier. I'm the Data Processing Manager for Legislative Affairs. I just wanted to expand on the conversation you're having about how we've come from just a few computers and a few things back in the 70s to where we're at today. We have, in fact, gotten through the PC Macintosh issues and buying standard equipment and such. Issues we have today with the way the language is currently in the statutes affects us in a couple areas. We do use the state's wide area network for communications, so we do sort of piggyback on what they do. Our communication services run over their wires. We don't have any problems with the executive branch and ETS. We work really well with them. We have a good relationship. But policies and procedures could come out in the future where the executive branch might have sort of an angle on the work we do here, and I think changing the language would be great for the separations of powers that we're all concerned with.
Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Kevin, follow-up question. Just the issue of the executive order, whether the executive order should, in fact, continue forward, and if the legislature wants to separate itself out, go ahead and do that. If the administration saw legislation in that was moving, poised to pass, that we mutually agreed on, is there a need to go ahead with the executive order, or do we need to have what would, I'm sure, be perceived in the press as the legislature fighting with the governor if we were to turn down the executive order and handle it through legislation? Do we need to go through that battle, or what's the best way going forward, I guess?
Through the chair. It's the administration's position the best way to go forward is to recognize the executive order, which basically recognizes the current way of doing business in the executive branch. And then if there are any changes that need to be made, that the legislative process is the appropriate way to do that. It's not mutually exclusive. In order to go forward, the sooner that we can recognize this, the better. And it may help the committee if we go back and to see one of the reasons why this came to a head. It came to the attention of the administration that each department has its own regulations for how they deal with requests for public information. Each department deals with itself and says, if you go to the Department of Law, you request information, here's what you have to do, here's the payment schedule, here's what we'll do. If you go to the Department of Education, they have a separate policy, and so on and so forth. So we said, well, let's create a statewide policy. It'll make it more clear, make it easier, make it more understandable for the people as to what they have to do to get public information. So we started down this path, and what the Department of Law told us is that we have to have a meeting with the governor, every commissioner, and LAA to sit down and write regulations so that we have a consistent policy for getting public information in a regulation. Getting the governor and every commissioner to sit down and try to write regulations for requests for public information was absurd. It's at the level, when we looked at that and we said, so what is the tick? We haven't done it the last 2 years. The Knowles administration didn't meet. The first 2 years that this administration didn't meet. What is it? What does it do? Well, it hasn't done anything. It's been too unwieldy, too overly bureaucratic, and quite frankly, just have too many people in there. The legislature has one vote on, I guess, a 16-member committee, and whether or not that's even constitutional when you're dealing with regulations of the executive branch is questionable. And so when we saw that, it is well within the governor's authority to try to, through executive order, to change the way the structure of the executive branch. So we see this as just recognizing a very inefficient system and moving to the efficient system that we are currently utilizing. That does not preclude legislation from being introduced and moving forward. That would exclude the legislature, encourage, you brought up the railroad. Those things can be discussed through the legislative process, but it doesn't remove the fact that today, if we want to move forward, we're going to have a meeting with all the commissioners, the governor, and LEA, as well as two non-voting members of the legislature, to try to get some basic things done. And it's just not an effective way or efficient way to do business. And so we think we should go forward with the executive order, and we would support the legislative process if they wanted to go further and look at what we should do prospectively.
Have you had an overview on the House side?
We did.
And did they express a desire one way or another, changes in statutes?
Through the
thing or stopping the executive order?
Through the chair, without characterizing their desire, they're going to do a committee bill which will exclude the legislature from the administration process. And it's just a clean cut, pure and simple. The legislature will not be a part of it. And we support that.
Now, mind you, because of the separation and the balance of powers in the building, that legislation can be vetoed. The executive order goes into effect, and we're under the administration. It seems to me that if we could collaborate on a piece of legislation that we all agree on and will pass and be signed into law, why would you not repeal the executive order?
Through the chair, there is no guarantee. There are two bodies. There are no guarantees in the legislature that something will get through both bodies. And I'm not so sure you can provide that guarantee with both bodies. Things happen, budgets come up, potentially gas line issues come up. And, you know, somebody sees this, gets leveraged to another bill, as some do, and it dies in a committee because somebody has heartache over another one. It's the legislative process is the legislative process, and there's no guarantees. We think it's too important to move forward with the more efficient system. And we stand by the executive order.
I don't think anybody really is, on your part or our part, is really itching for a fight over this. I mean, I just am looking for the most common sense way to move forward to assure that we can get where we want to go. Questions from committee members? Okay, we'll set aside the executive order 113. Probably have some discussion with leadership on what we should do. May entail introduction of a bill, working it with the executive, and possibly also introducing a resolution to turn down the executive order. Move those both forward, and if we can get agreement, we'll make a decision towards the end of the process exactly what combination of the two get us to where we want to go. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. And finally, we have Senate Bill 72. I'm not intending to take any action on the Senate bill today, but would like to just have the issue introduced. I think that I was involved the last time this was done, which is probably 15 years ago.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Annette Kreitzer, Chief of Staff to Lieutenant Governor Lehman, and I'm joined by
Scott Clark, Lieutenant Governor Lehman's notary administrator.
We worked really hard on this tag team presentation. Probably the easiest thing, Mr. Chairman, is if you'll look at this notary statute comparison, which should be in your backup. What I'd like to do is, I know the time is short this evening, and so I'd like to just go over the basic concepts in the bill for you to consider, and then if you choose to bring the bill back again, then we can talk more in specifics and more in depth if you'd like to do that. The things that we're changing, you know, the statutes haven't been changed since 1960s, and you did make an attempt, and we looked at your bill and looked at others that were out there. We've also vetted this with notaries. We use a listserv to talk to other notaries and see what they were thinking when we began to propose changes. We've talked, you'll have letters of support in your packet from National Notary Association. We've talked to the lobbyists for the insurance companies, for banks. We haven't heard from the credit unions, but so we vetted it pretty far and wide. Qualifications, What we're proposing is to lower the age to 18. There are only two states that make it a requirement that notaries be 19. That's Nebraska and us. And if this law passes, then Nebraska will be out there by itself. This was sought because many of the notaries that work in banks are 18 years of age, and so to make it easier on that branch of folks who are part of the 12,000 notaries in the state, we wanted to make that change. You'll recall Lieutenant Governor, when he was in the legislature, doesn't like to introduce new terms, and so as we looked through the law, we see that residency is defined in our statutes and notary statutes differently than in 01-10055, and that definition was sufficient for our needs, and so we just chose to use that definition rather than have a separate definition in our statutes. We did add a requirement the applicant must reside legally in the United States, and the applicant may not be convicted or incarcerated felons within 10 years of application.
Quick question. Yes. Legally within the United States, so does that mean that a person living abroad cannot notarize documents? They're a U.S. citizen, a military wife, overseas, somebody's got some paperwork to send back to the state, they can't notarize it?
Mr. Chairman, I need to look at the language in the bill, but from my memory, and I'll look at the language in the bill and make note of your question for the next time unless Scott knows the answer, but I believe what we're talking about are legal U.S. residents, citizens of the United States.
Mr. Chairman, notary commissions are generally restricted to a certain jurisdiction, so somebody that wasn't physically in the state of Alaska wouldn't qualify for an Alaska notary commission. They could apply for a commission in another country if they wanted. And this requires that they legally reside in the U.S. but not necessarily be citizens of the United States. So the
stamps can't travel outside the state?
That's right. We only have jurisdiction over our own area.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's why.
But on the other hand, since we have the question of out of country, do you recognize military officers' signature, which normally speaking is considered notarizing or witnessing, whichever interchangeable term you want? Do you recognize that?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins. Yes, the current statutes recognize the authority of commissioned military officers, and there's no change in this bill.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The terms, we've separated this into limited governmental notaries public and notaries public. So folks who are notary publics will continue to have a term of 4 years. Limited governmental notary public is an open-ended commission that will end when the state employee or federal employee or municipal employee ends their employment, rather than having them come back every 4 years if it's part of their job. The reason that they are a notary is because in the practice of their governmental job, they're notarizing governmental documents, not doing private notarization. So I wouldn't be able to bring, for instance, if you, Mr. Chairman, were a governmental notary, I wouldn't be bringing in my divorce papers or marriage papers or whatever I might want to notarize into you to have that done. The fees are going to be going up, not the $40 application fee, but the $2, what the term is folio in the law right now. We don't use that term anymore. We use the term certificate. It's going to be a $3 increase. Again, these statutes have not been changed since the 60s, but we still think that that's adequate, a $3 increase. So it would be a $5 per Lieutenant Governor certificate. The bond, there is not a rebond. Since we're creating this new limited governmental notary public, they're not required to post a bond because they are working for the state or the federal government or municipality, which would be self-insured. And we are required to keep those for 2 years. We and the commission.
Can we back up a little bit?
Yes.
I just, you know, every time a politician goes out in the public and whether it's the legislature that raises a fee or the administration that proposes a fee raising, we catch the brunt of it. So the $3 increase on the Lieutenant Governor's certificate, how much is that going to raise? And what is the necessity of raising that fee?
Well, I can answer the first part of it. It's $8,700. That's the fiscal note that's with the bill. It's a positive fiscal note. And then I'll let Scott, we did do some analysis of whether what we were charging was adequate and didn't seek to increase the fee just to increase the fee because the statutes hadn't been changed. If the $2 had been sufficient, then we would not have increased it. But I'll let Scott speak to the specifics.
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, the $2 has been in effect since 1961. And maybe I should clarify what these certificates are. This doesn't involve every notary. These are certificates that verify details about notarizations. They're usually required for documents that are going to foreign countries. The Rotary Exchange students, for example, might need to have their transcripts from the schools that they attended here authenticated through this process before their home country would accept them. So we do about 3,000 of these a year, and they're really fancy certificates with gold foil seals stating facts about the notary and the act that they performed. And it's a requirement in many cases before foreign countries will accept these documents. And $2 was not covering the actual cost to produce the certificate. So $5 is fair, and Alaska will still be at $5, one of the cheapest states. Many states charge $20 or $25 a piece for these documents. So we think it's a reasonable increase.
So it's clearly not the standard notarization that a person would go into the bank to get.
This has nothing to do with the act of notarization.
Okay.
The public will experience generally.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman, for clarifying that for anyone who's watching, because that's an important point. The commission types, again, we're creating now this limited governmental notary public. Actually, it's being expanded, to include municipal and federal employees in addition to state employees. So what we've done is made it very clear that you can have these commissions concurrently. You can be a limited governmental notary public in your job, but then if you also wanted to be a private notary, you could continue to do that, and you would charge a fee for that on the side if you were doing that out of your home or you had a different business. So the limited governmental notary is public because the thought is that you're working for the government, you're notarizing documents for people ostensibly because the government required it, and so we don't feel it's appropriate to be charging a fee for that. It's just hitting the consumer twice if you were, and so that's the difference between those two commission types. Did you have a question, Mr. Chairman?
And the limited, is it limited to the specific job when they apply for that limited right or power? They specify what it is that they, what transaction they're notarizing in a day-to-day business? Or
Mr. Chairman, let me try to be more clear. We call it a limited governmental notaries public because they're limited to governmental actions, that they work for government. I'm saying that a little wrong, not that they're limited to governmental actions, but that they work for a governmental entity. They can do all the same notarizations that notary public can. It's where they work, that they work for either the federal, state, or municipal government, and that they will not be charging a fee. And that's what differentiates the two. They can both do the same notary action, whatever is allowed by law.
They will not be charging a fee,
right?
But they can notarize things for the general public.
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman. Yes, they can notarize things for the general public. But for instance, in our office, we don't get people coming in asking. Generally, people will go to a bank, or if you have something that needs to be notarized, you'll go to a facility where that's provided, like car dealerships. I think they provide notaries on site a lot of times. If you're getting a loan, someone at the bank is a notary. So it's available there. We're not trying to compete with the private sector. What we have is, but on the other hand, if you're in a government building and you are given this form that says it has to be notarized, it's very helpful to have somebody on the premises who's a notary, and you don't have to go trek across to the bank or go somewhere else to have that done and pay for it.
But if I were to go to a governmental office,
mm-hmm.
I just happen to know the person's a notary, they could notarize it. Or do they have specific power to say, no, I would rather not do that, I have a limited, and I just don't do private?
Mr. Chairman, the bill specifically prohibits page 10, line 29.
And 30.
That
limited governmental notaries public may perform notarial acts only in the conduct of official government business.
So it is limited. And is that a new restriction?
It is. We've repealed and readopted most of this statute. And we went through it with a fine-tooth comb, but anything that you find that seems of sync to you, we're certainly willing to go back and take another look at. We've run it through department law a couple of times, and again through the notaries that we're in contact with and the trade organizations, but we're still open to any suggestions that you have. Commission revocation, this has come up a couple of times where we've had people complain for one reason or another about a notary, and right now the only procedure available is the Administrative Procedure Act, which is a very cumbersome process, and it doesn't matter how trivial the complaint is. There's really nothing we can do except refer a person to the Administrative Procedure Act, and what we're putting in here, last year you remember the legislature passed the Administrative Hearing Officer Bill. And so that is now going to be in effect for many departments, and so we would come under that as well. But we would also have the ability, the Lieutenant Governor would have the ability to review complaints and see if they're trivial and dismiss them and have it over with. Right now, what happens is people call, and then we refer them to Administrative Procedure Act, and then they will call back again. It's too cumbersome. Isn't there something else I can do? And there really is very little resolution for them where this provides a much clearer procedural mechanism for people who have complaints. The notary data, the other thing that we're trying to do is move to a more web-based system, but in doing that, we don't want to inadvertently expose people's email address to public records requirements. And so what we'd like to do is keep what currently is public. The public needs to know who's a notary, where they're a notary, and how to reach that notary. That's all going to remain public information, but what we'd like to keep as private information is their email address and other information, fax numbers that they may not want to share with the general public, so that we can continue to communicate with them and offer them more education and really work with the notaries and provide a website that's going to be much more useful to them. And the last part there is the question that Senator Huggins raised, which is about non-commissioned notaries. There are no changes in the bill to that. They still have the same powers they've always had.
Questions from committee members? Senator Wagner.
Just a statement, and I hope we never get to the point, states such as the state of California, that one thing they did with their state law, they now, when they issue the license to be a notary, and they say you may not charge over $25 to notarize a signature. Well, now everybody in the state of California wants to charge $25 for that service. So let's avoid that at all costs.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, thank you for your indulgence. And just to that point, that's come up a couple of times in committees, and believe me, the Lieutenant Governor has no intention of going down that road that you suggest. The next time that you'd have the bill before you, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to point out that there is a proposed amendment, and in the House, this question came up about electronic notarizations, and you know the legislature has sort of looked at electronic signatures over the last couple of years, and as we looked at the language of the statutes, what we wanted to do was take advantage of this opportunity to remove any impediments to electronic notarization in the future. We do not wish to define what electronic notarizations would look like. All we're trying to do with this amendment would be to just remove the language that says, for instance, handwritten signature. That's not going to cover, for instance, electronic notarization. And so that's what we've tried to do in working with the Department of Law, is come up with some language that would allow us to do that if the committee is willing to consider that amendment. If you'll just take a look at it in the meantime, before the bill comes up before you again.
So, give me an example of electronic notarization.
I'll let Scott do that. I can tell you that
it's... notarization is, yes, this person did sign that document on that day, and I saw them. How do we...
Mr. Chairman, and that aspect of notarization is vital and will not change when we move into the electronic world, and the bill will take care of that and make sure that electronic notarizations in the future are held to the same standards that current notarizations are. As far as what one looks like, that's the problem. Several states have attempted pilot programs and have fallen on their face. We're still working out the details across the country of how electronic notarization is going to work. I'm pretty sure it's not too far off in the future, but there's so many different types of computer systems, hardware, software, digital signatures and electronic signatures are common right now, but to add the security inherent in a notarization, and then also the worldwide system that I hinted at earlier, where documents are traveling between countries and notarizations are authenticated and verified between countries. We're still working out the details of that system. So
the current wording here removes impediments to move to that through regulatory changes?
Bill? No. Let me answer. Excuse me.
I'm not sure I want to give you that authority.
No, we do not want to have and are not seeking regulatory authority. What we're trying to do here, and it's the legislature's call, what we're trying to do here is prepare the way for a future legislature, if and when the technology catches up to electronic notarizations, that the legislature could define what that would look like. If you have any discomfort with the amendment when you have a chance to review it that makes it appear like we're looking for regulatory authority, we're open to any amendment. Or if the legislature, it's your policy call, doesn't wish to consider the amendment. But I just want to explain what we're trying to do here. And if your attorneys tell you that that's not what this amendment does, then we're happy to
now,
hear.
Do we have the amendment? Because I know that.
I think so.
Electronic means as authorized by regulations adopted by the Lieutenant Governor. That's language to be added. Seems to me like that'd be granting you the authority.
Mr. Chairman, again, I take that as you can't adopt regulations where technology doesn't exist. And so I'm...
But if it came into existence tomorrow, you'd be pre-approved to do it.
To the extent that the law would allow... I don't have any problem taking it out, removing the regulations portion. Well, all we really are after here is removing impediments for a future legislature. And I think it should be defined by a future legislature. I think the Lieutenant Governor would agree with that not without public comment.
It seems like a future legislature that wants to make that policy call would remove the impediments at that time. So I just need to understand.
Sure.
And we'll probably talk to our drafters about this.
Sure.
Further questions?
Mr. Chairman, could I just go through this a moment? I wanted to introduce Brian Westad, who is interning in our office and is also working on this bill, so you may be seeing him testify in committee when I'm not available. And just wanted you to see. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Then we will close the overview on Senate Bill 72. Let the members know if... I'd like to move on it. There seems like there's a few issues here to look into, but we'll try to get back to it fairly soon.
Thank you, Mr.
With that concludes our hearing for today.